This is East End Inc. Colson Whitehead won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature and the National Book Award for his novel Underground Railroad. In August 2019, Colson Whitehead talked about his latest novel, The Nickel Boys, and his work as an author at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the South Fork in Bridgehampton, New York. The program was sponsored by Canyon's Cultural Cafe of Sag Harbor.
I got the idea for The Nickel Boys from reading a newspaper report. You know, I get ideas from a lot of different kinds of places. I got an idea for a book from a dream once. It was Zone One came from a dream. I grew up watching a lot of horror movies at a very early age and saw things, you know, I was perhaps maybe too young to see. I saw Night of the Living Dead when I was like 10. Remember Night of the Living Dead, a zombie movie. The main character is a black man. I hadn't seen that in a lot of movies, late 70s. And he's being pursued by a white mob who wants to rip him limb from limb and destroy him, sort of a metaphor for America. And it stayed with me. I saw Dawn of the Dead, of course, the second in Romero's Dead trilogy. 2 years later, I was like 12. And since then, I had dreams, zombie dreams, for every month, for decades. Sometimes they were fast, you know, sometimes they were slow. Sometimes they'd catch me or not, talk or not, depending on my anxiety level that year. And this went on for decades and decades, like I said. Until 2009, I was going through a rough patch in my life and still having zombie dreams. And it was the summer, and we were having guests out to our place on Hempstead Street. It was my aunt's house, Sag Harbor. We rented it for a month, July 4th. My grandfather built it. The walls are very thin. It's basically a no-sex house, as I try to make sure everyone knows when they come out. So, like, July 4th, we'd love to have you. We're going to have some barbecuing, no sex, fireworks. And we had, you know, guests that July 4th. And I woke up, I heard our friends laughing downstairs because the walls were so thin. And I was like, I just can't deal. I'm going through a rough patch. I just want to go back to sleep. So I willed myself back to sleep, which is a skill I've developed over the years. And I had a dream. And in the dream, I was in Manhattan in my apartment. And I wanted to go into the living room, but I didn't know if it was safe because I didn't know if they'd cleared the zombies out yet. And so I woke up and I was like, oh, that's a cool idea for a book. What do you do when the apocalypse is winding down? You have these zombies, stragglers. Someone has to get rid of them. And so I was very lucky. Usually, if you have an idea in the middle of the night and write it down, you know, you wake up in the morning, it's like flying squirrels. That's not a novel. Maybe a short story. In the case of the Underground Railroad, you know, I was just sitting on my couch in my apartment in Brooklyn. It was the spring of 2000. I was lying in a depressive nap, post-nap haze, sort of common in my life. And I was reading something and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad and remembered how, when I was a little kid, those words were so evocative, I thought it was a literal train beneath the earth, which is obviously very impractical. You know, we have 20 miles of track subways in New York City, and we can barely keep that going. So thousands of miles of track beneath the earth is really impractical. I know I'm not the only person who thought that, you know. Some people actually go their whole lives thinking the Underground Railroad is a real train. I gave a talk in Florida a year and a half ago, and a woman came up to me before the talk. She'd read the book and said, have there been any studies about the cave-ins? And I was like, no, sorry? And she said, well, yeah, you know, there were thousands of miles of track. You know, it must have been an engineering miracle. Have there been studies about the cave-ins? And I was like, really? Which just goes to show you how evocative those words are and how crappy our educational system is. So I had this kooky idea, it was 19 years ago, what if this metaphorical train was a literal train? That'd be a cool premise for a story. There's not much story there, so I added the element that each state that our protagonist goes through is a different state of American possibility, like Gulliver's Travels. Gulliver's Travels, it's the Odyssey, Pilgrim's Progress, any sort of these classic stories where someone is tested in a series of allegorical challenges on their way to enlightenment. And I thought it was such a good idea that day that I knew if I tried it back then, I would have screwed it up. I thought if I wrote some more books, I might become a better writer and be able to pull it off in a technical sense. If I was older and more mature, I might be able to deal with the subject of slavery in the way that it required. If I, you know, saw the world, had some Hemingway-esque adventures, stabbed a hobo with a penknife or something, I could bring that life experience to the book and make the story live on the page. So each time I finished the book, I would, you know, pull out my notes and ask myself, am I ready? And the answer is always no. And this went on for years and years until 2014, when I had sold the book to my editor, but I was having some doubts about it. So I decided to tell my wife about this Underground Railroad idea that I'd had for so many years. As many of you know, sometimes in a marriage, you have to make conversation to kill the silences. So I told my wife, and she just said, well, honey, I don't want to say that the book you're working on now about a Brooklyn writer going through a midlife crisis is dumb per se, but this other book sounds really good. So I was like, huh. I decided to tell my agent, who I worked with for 20 years. She's always very supportive. And she just said, well, Colson, both ideas sound good, which is not very helpful. But then she did something she never does, which was email me on a Sunday. And she said, I was like, what do I do now? What do I do? And she just said, I can't stop thinking about this other idea of yours, about the Underground Railroad. So that was two votes. Wednesday was shrink day, so I told my shrink. And she just said, what are you, crazy? I mean, we both know you're crazy, but yeah, with your issues, you should totally work on this book or whatever. So that just left my editor, who I'd already sold this other idea to. And so, with some trepidation, I called him up, and he just said, giddy up, motherfucker, which is old school publishing talk for, that sounds very compelling and we should pursue it. So I did, and that's the book that happened. But like I said, with the Nickel Boys, I got the idea from a newspaper report about the real-life Dozier School for Boys. It opened as the Florida School for Boys in Mariana, Florida, on January 1st, 1900. It was New Year's Day, the start of a new century, with all the optimism that that entails. And the idea for the reform school was a very enlightened one. How do we take care of juvenile offenders? We don't want to lock them up with adult criminals. They'll become more criminalized. So let's concentrate on rehabilitation, give them schooling one day, maybe farm work the next, they'll learn a trade, and maybe they can get on the right path. But from the start, disturbing news reports made their way to the outside world. In 1903, inspectors went and found kids as young as six years old shackled to the wall. Students told of violent beatings. More investigations found their other grim findings about unhealthy conditions. Reforms were enacted decade after decade. The administration stopped leasing students to local businesses because sometimes the students would end up dead. Corporal punishment and the use of dark cells, solitary confinement, was discontinued. They disassembled the sweat boxes, the iron cages where students were baked in the sun for attitude adjustment. And they renamed the place a few times as if a new brand might help. The Florida Industrial School for Boys, the Arthur G. Dozier School for Boys. And always over time that the cruelty resumed. The dark cells were reopened. A concrete utility shed called the White House became the new home of the spankings, where boys were whipped with a leather strap called Black Beauty. The students nicknamed the White House the Ice Cream Factory because they said you came out with bruises of every color. The boys continued to tell their stories of sexual abuse, torture, and even homicide for decades and decades until state investigators closed the school down in 2011. I read about it in 2014, and when the national media picked up the story of the school. The state wanted to sell the land, and so they exhumed the bodies in the official graveyard for identification and relocation, and they discovered other unmarked graves strewn across the old school, and bodies that testified to horrific violence, blunt trauma to skulls, shotgun pellets in rib cages. Boys had disappeared. Their families had been told they'd been run off, when in fact they were actually in the ground, still on the school property. So like I said, it was the summer of 2014. Michael Brown, an unarmed teenager, had been shot to death in Ferguson, Missouri, by a white policeman. Eric Garner was choked to death in Staten Island by a white policeman. With the rise of cell phone cameras, everyday acts of violence against black people were being recorded. But the devices didn't record a sudden spike in incidents. They merely recorded the standard level of brutality. We have the technology to see it now, the things that happen every day, the way a new telescope doesn't discover new galaxies. It only renders visible the ancient stars that have always been there. Despite the evidence, no one is ever held accountable for incidents like the one I just described. Just a week and a half ago, Barr, our attorney general, declared that no charges would be filed in the Eric Garner case. Dozier, it seemed, in that summer of violence, seemed to provide more evidence. For over 100 years, the school had been in the business of mangling the lives of young boys, and the perpetrators went unpunished. They retired, the guards, lived long, happy lives, and in some cases received Citizen of the Year awards for their community. Most of the White House boys who came forward were white, but the majority were African-American. And I wondered about the black students and what a novel inspired by Dozier might look like. It is a novel. You know, I've been asked a few times why it's not a non-fiction book. I'm not a hard news guy. I'm not a journalist. I think you should, you know, stay in your lane. You wouldn't go to Picasso and say, oh, I like this painting you did about the Spanish Civil War, Guernica. Did you ever think about doing an interpretive dance or something? That's not his medium. You wouldn't go to Charles Darwin and say, oh, I love this book you did about evolution, the origin of the species, or whatever you call it. Why did you forsake the structural elegance of the haiku, a 5-7-5 exploration of how we got here? Just stay in your lane. When I first started writing 20 years ago, I'd sometimes get anxious about whether something I was putting down the page would make sense to other people. A description of a place, an emotion, or a way of looking at something. I'm such a weirdo, frankly, that it seemed unlikely that other people could relate to what I was trying to put down there. But of course, that's a writer's job, to find the right words so that other people can see things the same way you do. And then there's the other thing, which is that the world is pretty large. There's 7.5 billion people. And if it's true for me, I thought, odds are maybe it's true for one other person, no matter how alone we can all feel sometimes. And if there's one other person who sees it the same way, maybe there's dozens or thousands. And if I can hit upon the right combination of words, maybe thousands and thousands of people can see it the way that I see it. And this calmed my nerves the next time I sat down to write. But there's a flip side about numbers. If something is happening in one place, it's happening in other places as well. If there's one Dozier, then there's dozens and dozens of reform schools where the same tragedies are unfolding. Or if not a reform school, maybe it's an orphanage, an unwed home for mothers in Dublin, a residential school in Canada, where indigenous children were ripped from their families so that they could be educated in white culture, and where the same sort of brutalities occurred. Or maybe it's a for-profit incarceration camp on our southern border where refugee children sleep in cages. It's any place where a culture of impunity reigns, destroys, and ruins. And that's the thing about numbers. They can calculate our common humanity and also multiply our human weakness. I had a place. I needed characters. Sometimes a fragment of my personality makes its way into my characters or the supporting cast, and sometimes not. Cora, the protagonist of the Underground Railroad, has the least amount of me in her, which is probably why it's my most popular book to date. I just couldn't help but notice. To create the two heroes for the Nickel Boys, I borrowed from my own internal dilemma. The last 2.5 years have been a time of great division in America. These divisions and hatreds and disputes have always been with us, but sometimes they're closer to the surface if someone or something brings them closer to the surface. The world's often quite terrible. I like to think that the world is getting better for my children, for the children they might have today, the same way my parents and grandparents, despite the racial injustice of the time they were born in, hope that their offspring would grow up in a better world. We make progress and take 2 steps back, and this seems to be our depressing trend, and it starves the optimists among us while nourishing the pessimists.
This is East End, Inc. We're listening to author Colson Whitehead talking about his latest novel, The Nickel Boys.
So for Nickel Boys, I picked 2 protagonists that spoke to different parts of my personality, the hopeful one, and then the more pragmatic or cynical or realistic one, depending how you want to phrase it. For Elwood, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. provides a model of engagement with the world. If you stand up, if you fight for justice, you can remake the social order. For Turner, my second character, he survived by seeing the world as it actually is, not how we want it to be. So for him, the staff and administration of the Nickel Academy, my stand-in for the Dozier School, they become stand-ins themselves for all the malevolent forces that grind us down. And when Elwood and Turner meet, their debate about how to live and exist begins. And for me, that's the heart of the story, the war between these 2 philosophies. So I'll read a brief section. The boys rooted for Griff, even though he was a miserable bully who jimmied and pried at your weaknesses and made up weaknesses if he couldn't find any, such as calling you a knock-kneed piece of even if your knees had never knocked your whole life. He tripped them and laughed at the ensuing pratfalls and slapped them around when he could get away with it. He punked them out, dragging them into dark rooms. He smelled like a horse and made fun of their mothers, which was pretty low given the general motherlessness of the student population. He stole the desserts on multiple occasions, swiped from trays with a grin, and even if the desserts themselves were no great shakes, it was the principle. The boys rooted for Griff because he was going to represent the colored half of Nickel at the annual boxing match, and no matter what he did the rest of the year, the day of the fight, he would be all of them in one black body, and he was going to knock that white boy out. If Griff spat teeth before that happened, swell. The Nickel Academy was a reform school for boys, juvenile offenders, wards of the state, orphans, runaways who lit away to get away from mothers who entertained men for money, or to escape rummy fathers who came into their rooms in the middle of the night. Some of them had stolen money or cussed at their teachers or damaged public property. They told stories about bloody pool hall fights or uncles who sold moonshine. A bunch of them were sent there for offenses they never heard of. Malingering, mopery, incorrigibility. Words the boys didn't understand, but what was the point when the meaning was clear enough? Nickel. The combat served as a kind of mollifying spell to tide them through the daily humiliations. The colored boys had held the boxing title for 15 years, since 1949. Old hands on the staff remembered the last white champion and still talked them up. Other things from the old days they discussed less often. Terry Doc Burns had been an anvil-handed good old boy from a musty corner of Sewanee County who'd been sent to Nickel for strangling a neighbor's chickens, 21 chickens to be exact, because they were, quote, out to get him, unquote. Pain rolled off him like rain from a slate roof. After Doc Burns had returned to the free world, the white boys who had advanced to the final fight were pikers, so wobbly that over the years, tall tales about the former champion had grown more and more extravagant. Nature had gifted Doc Burns with unnaturally long reach. His legendary combo had swatted down all comers and rattled windows. In fact, Doc Burns had been beaten and ill-treated by so many in his life, family, and strangers alike, that by the time he arrived at Nickel, all punishments were gentle breezes. This was Griff's first term on the boxing team. He'd arrived at Nickel in February, right after the graduation of the previous champ, Axel Parks. His emergence as the baddest brother on campus had made him Axel's natural successor. Griff was a giant, broad-chested and hunched, like a big brown bear. His daddy, it was said, was on a chain gang in Alabama for killing his mother, making his meanness a handed-down thing. Outside the ring, Griff made a hobby of terrorizing the weaker boys, the boys without friends, the weepy ones. Inside the ring, his prey stepped right up so he didn't have to waste time hunting. Like an electric toaster or an automated washing machine, boxing was a modern convenience that made life easier. The coach for the color team was a Mississippian named Max David, who worked in the school garage. He got an envelope at the end of the year for imparting what he'd learned during his welterweight stint. Max David made his pitch to Griff early in the summer. "My first fight made me cockeyed," he said, "and my farewell fight set my eyes right again. So trust me when I say this sport will break you down to build you up again, and that's a fact." Griff smiled. He pulverized and unmanned his opponents with cruel inevitability throughout autumn. He was not graceful. He was not a scientist. He was a powerful instrument of violence, and that sufficed. Given the typical length of enrollment at Nickel, most students were only around for one or two boxing seasons. As the championship approached, the boys had to be schooled in the importance of those December matches, the prelims within your dorm, the match between your dorm's best guy and the best sluggers from the other two dorms, then the bout between the best black fighter and whatever chump the white guys put up. The championship was their sole acquaintance with justice at Nickel. Trevor Nickel had instituted the championship matches in 1946, soon after he came on as a director of the Nickel Academy. He'd never run a school before. His background was in agriculture. He made an impression at Klan meetings, however, with his impromptu speeches on moral improvement and the value of work, the disposition of young souls in need of care. The right people remembered his passion when an opening came up. His first Christmas at the school gave the county the chance to witness his improvements. Everything that needed a new coat of paint got a new coat of paint. The dark cells were briefly converted to more innocent use. And the regular beatings relocated to the small white utility building, nicknamed the White House. Had the good people of Eleanor, Florida, seen the industrial fan that was kept in the White House to mask the sound of the screams, they might have had a question or two, but the shed was not part of the tour. Nickel was a longtime boxing evangelist, had steered a lobbying group for its expansion in the Olympics. Boxing had always been popular in the school, but the new director took the sport's expansion as his remit. The athletics budget, long an easy target for directors on the skim, was rejiggered to pay for regulation equipment and to bolster the coaching staff. Nickel had maintained a general interest in fitness. He possessed a fervent belief in the miracle of a human specimen in top shape, and often watched the boys shower to monitor the progress of their physical education. "The director," Elwood said when Turner told him that last part. "Where do you think Dr. Campbell got that idea?" Turner said. Nickel was gone now, but Dr. Campbell, the school psychologist, was known to loiter at the white boys' showers to pick his dates. "All these dirty old men got a club together," Turner said. Elwood had met Turner his second day at Nickel in the mess hall, which was loud with the rumble and roil of juvenile activity. Turner had bobbed in his own pocket of calm. Over time, Elwood saw that he was always simultaneously at home in whatever scene he found himself in, and also seemed like he shouldn't have been there, inside and above at the same time, apart and apart. Now he and Turner were hanging out in the bleachers while Griff sparred with Cherry, a mulatto who'd taken up boxing as a matter of pedagogy to teach others how not to speak about his white mother. He was quick and lithe, and Griff clobbered him. Catching Griff and his regimen was a favorite occupation those early days in December. Boys from the colored dormitories made the rounds, as well as white scouts from down the hill who wanted a skinny. Griff had been excused from his kitchen shift since summer to train. It was a spectacle. Max David kept him on a diet of raw eggs and oats and kept the jug of what he said was goat's blood in the icebox. When the coach administered the doses, Griff swallowed the stuff with a lot of theater and then mortified the heavy bag in revenge. Turner had seen Axel fight during his first term in Nickel 2 years prior. Axel had been slow on his feet, but as solid and abiding as an old stone bridge. He'd weathered what the skies decreed. Contrary to Griff, with his mealy disposition, he was kind and protective of the smaller kids. "I wonder where he is now," Turner said. "That nigga didn't have a lick of sense. Making things worse for himself, probably, wherever he is." Cherry wavered and sank on his ass. Griff spat out his mouthpiece and bellowed. His friend and training companion, Black Mike, a wiry youth from Opelousas, stepped into the sparring ring and held Griff's hand up like Lady Liberty's torch. The likely white contender was a boy named Big Chet, who came from a clan of swamp people and was a bit of a creature. "Do you think he'll knock him down?" Elwood asked. "Look at those arms, man," Turner said. "Those things are pistons or smoked hams." To see Griff quiver with unspent energy after a match, two young kids unlacing his gloves like retainers, it was hard to imagine how the giant could lose, which was why, 2 days later, Turner sat up in surprise when he heard the school's superintendent, Spencer, tell Griff to take a dive. So I'll stop there. It's cliffhanger, baby.
This is East End Inc. We heard Colson Whitehead talking about his novel, The Nickel Boys, published by Doubleday in 2019. Colson Whitehead's other work includes Underground Railroad from Doubleday in 2016, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Literature and the National Book Award, and Zone One in 2012, Sag Harbor in 2010, and John Henry Days in 2002, all from Penguin Random House. Here are some upcoming free literary events on the East End. Canna's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor presents marine biologist Carl Safina, author of View from Lazy Point and Song for the Blue Ocean, in conversation with environmentalist fisherman Paul Greenberg about his book Omega Principle, Seafood and the Quest for Long Life and a Healthier Planet, on Saturday, October 5th at 5 p.m. More events are listed at caneos.com. East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasional 5th Wednesday each month. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Please search for East End Inc. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callendrell and Catherine Zilker. I'm Hazel Kahn.